Welcome to episode 4 of Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug, Pillars of Eternity. We'll be talking all about Pillars of Eternity, Obsidian Entertainment's new RPG, their kickstarted RPG. I'm fortunate enough to be joined today by at least a couple of dragons for the moment, and we'll see if more pop in. I've kind of broadcast the Hangout link to a couple of different places. I think I will let everyone introduce themselves. I'll kick it off. I am Withstand the Fury Dragon, or I guess now more commonly known as just WTF Dragon. I went by that acronym a little bit, at least, before its meaning became what it was today, but there you go. I'm the founder and kind of the main editor behind the Ultima Codex, and Ultima Era before that. One-stop shop for Ultima fan project news, and then eventually just any kind of news that even sort of tangentially relates to Ultima. There have been a lot of spiritual successors and inspired buys that have come along, and not just fan projects, but you know, actual official games, if you will. Okay, and I'm going to kick this over to Linguistic. Why don't you say hi?
Oh, joy. Hello, I'm Linguistic Dragon. Fairly semi-new to the dragon community. I've been a dragon for about a year, but haven't really been active up until several months ago. I guess my dragon claim to fame is I write the Ultima Journeys blog. I'm currently making my way through the series, just writing my impressions on the games as I make my way through them. Currently in the middle of Ultima 5, which has kind of stalled out a bit due to Pillars of Eternity, so I figured this was a good time to come in. So, hello!
Alrighty. And?
And I am Bullion Dragon, better known as Sanctimonia, the developer of course, Sanctimonia, and more recently, the shoot-em-up Sylph.
Okay, so, right, off to topic then. So, Pillars of Eternity, what is it? In brief, it's Obsidian Entertainment's latest RPG. It was released just a couple of weeks ago. In turn, about 2 years, if memory serves, after it was quite successfully funded via Kickstarter. There have been some interesting stories that have come out around that, of course, how, one of the common themes has been how, you know, Pillars and its funding through Kickstarter basically saved Obsidian after the cancellation of what we really only know as Project North Carolina. The studio kind of fell on some hard times. They were having trouble getting projects, and so after some discussion, they came up with this Pillars of Eternity concept. It was called Project Eternity at the time, and they pitched it on Kickstarter, and they made a big pile of money, and then they made the game. So, as mentioned, it was released a couple of weeks ago. It casts players in the role of the Watcher, a uniquely gifted individual who can perceive the souls of others, and if I understand correctly, not just the souls of other living people, but also souls that have passed through areas before. It is also designed, in part, as a throwback to the Infinity Engine RPGs of the late 1990s and early 2000s. Games like Baldur's Gate, Planescape Torment, Icewind Dale. Obsidian's stated mission with Pillars on their website is to recapture the magic, the imagination, the depth, and nostalgia of classic RPGs that we enjoyed making and playing. And although it has been built with the modern and now thoroughly ubiquitous Unity 3D engine, it tried to recapture the isometric, essentially 2D look of those older Infinity Engine games, adding modern conventions here and there sparingly, and only where it'll improve that overall old-school experience. So, I'm busy, I run the Codex, I run a scout group, I have kids, I have a job. So I haven't had a lot of time to dive into Pillars personally. That said, it is probably going to capture the record of at least the Infinity Engine type game that I'll stick with the longest, which was previously held by Icewind Dale. I actually have to confess, I'm not the biggest fan of the Infinity Engine in general, or the style of RPG that it gave rise to. Not that I don't like the heavily narrative RPGs per se, but I've never really enjoyed the world craft that has been apparent in stuff like Baldur's Gate or Planescape Torment even. I've never really enjoyed navigating through the scenery there. I've never really enjoyed the combat engine over much either. Icewind Dale, the first one, is probably the one exception. I can futz around with that for, you know, an hour here and an hour there. I've probably, you know, sunk maybe 20 hours into the game total. And, you know, it's the story's all right. I gather that it's kind of the lesser of those series of games. It's kind of more action-oriented. I find the aesthetic a little bit more appealing. I like the art style, you know, the wintry scenery, things like that, a little bit better. But that's about as far as it goes. But so far, having played what little of Pillars I have, I have to say that I am kind of getting hooked, and I do actually wish I had more time to throw at it. It seems like a really interesting concept. The world seems... there's a few interesting philosophical conceits, and Linguistic may be able to speak to this a little bit better, having progressed further in the game. I find, you know, like one of the most... engaging aspects of the game that has been revealed so far is, of course, you know, the fact that souls are contra within, you know, our own philosophy here in the world, as you know, to whether the soul exists or not. Within Pillars of Eternity, the existence of the soul is a known fact. Like, these are perceptible, not necessarily tangible, that's the wrong word, but, you know, they are perceptible, verifiably present things within the universe, within the world, within individuals within the world. And so much that they're, you know, a subject of study, and, of course, you know, we have characters like the Watcher who can directly perceive them. Philosophical conceits like that pretty much always draw me in. It was much the same with Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning, which didn't necessarily explore the concept as well as it should have. I gather that that was being fleshed out for the sequel, which of course will never come now, thank you, Rhode Island. But, you know, they had something similar going for it there. It's like, you know, here is this totally deterministic world. Everything is ruled by fate, except you. So, those are my initial impressions. I like the world that Obsidian has built. The rocks that grow, I can't remember the name of them. It's not Arda, but... Or is it Arda? Anyways, it's, you know, like, that's neat. The scenery they've designed is generally gorgeous. Linguistic says it's Aedra. There we go. Almost Arda. Arda's Tolkien. Arda's the name of the world in Tolkien. So, yeah, those are my initial impressions. But as I say, I've not had time to get nearly as far into it as Linguistic has had, so I'm going to kick that over because I think Linguistic will have a fair bit more to say about the matter.
Well, I suppose we'll find out, won't we? I don't have a whole lot of experience with the Infinity Engine games myself. I played Baldur's Gate for a while, Icewind Dale for a bit. Planescape Torment just absorbed me for quite a while. So that's the one I know best of the Infinity Engine games, but I never got far with Baldur's Gate 2 or Icewind Dale 2. The thing that really appealed to me about them as a whole, to varying degrees, was the storytelling. I'm big on story in games. I love analyzing the way they approach narrative. And one thing that the Infinity Engine games do that I don't see a lot in other games is take advantage of subtlety and nuance in dialogue, because there's so much more to a conversation than just the actual spoken words. And all of those games, to some degree or another, take advantage of describing body language, of furtive glances, and you know, little shifts in the character you're speaking with. And when it comes to Pillars of Eternity, I'm seeing a whole lot of that, which I'm absolutely loving. There's the whole thing revolves around souls, as you said, and the idea that these souls get recycled over the as time goes on. So the soul one person has may be the same soul that some warrior had in some distant time, and the Watcher can essentially see the history of those souls. And so sometimes you're looking at one character who is aware of their soul's past history. And the way they write the dialogue, the way they write the character, you're seeing basically two characters in one single soul, and they're very distinctive, even though you're only seeing text on a screen. And oh boy, words are hard sometimes, but it's the way it's described that really gets me. There's I was actually playing a little bit earlier today, and there's one character you come across. It's, you know, your traditional quest giver. This is what I want you to do. This is the situation. But you approach him, and it says that you come up behind him, and he looks at you with an expression that you're not sure is surprise or fear. And it looks like he's not sure about that either. And that's just something you can't really get, or not really, you don't really see much in a lot of games, that subtlety in the look, in the character. It doesn't just rely on the dialogue. Every facet of it of the writing contributes to the feel of the story and the atmosphere of the setting as a whole. And dead air.
Yeah, to reflect a bit on some of your observations. I haven't actually played the game, so I can't speak to the exact implementation of what you speak, but I do think, however, a lot of games, particularly games where it matters, such as role-playing games, actually fail to properly humanize a lot of the characters by not displaying a lot of the things that normal people can actually associate with people doing, that act as a bridge to connect the player to someone in the game who is otherwise in a context that's difficult to connect with, such as being extremely powerful, like a warrior, you know, a wizard or a magician. It's difficult to relate to a lot of the characters because of the extreme nature of the story. So subtle, you know, facial expressions, like someone scratching their nose, you know, or somebody actually having to go to the bathroom, you never really see a lot of these small details that actually, you know, make the characters human beings. So it's interesting that it sounds like they're trying to capture some of those nuances in the game. I think that's extremely important if you're really trying to make a role-playing game connect with the players.
Well, I mean, we see a little bit of that in the Ultima series as well. Like, if you actually look at most of the dialogue in most Ultima games, it's, I mean, obviously in the earlier ones, it's very, very perfunctory because they only had a few K to play with, a few K of memory to play with anyways. And even in stuff like, let me back that up a little bit. So they had a few K of memory to play with in like some of the earlier games, and you get to stuff like Ultima 4 a little bit, Ultima 5 more so, Ultima 6 more so. Where you start to see little bit more description creeping in. There's stuff coming up in Ultima 5 that I quite look forward to seeing Linguistic's take on. I can remember that, other people who've blogged through the series have, tended to, there's a couple of scenes, particularly in Ultima 5, where people have tended to remark upon, just how riveting it was, in spite of the fact that it's, a late 80s RPG that fits into a couple of megabytes, and so, obviously, there's not a ton of description there. Then, of course, I like Ultima 6. Obviously, it does some wonderful things with its narrative, despite, again, the relative simplicity of the actual written text within the game in comparison to Ultima 7, which of course has a lot of that same kind of text where you're not just now it's not just what I say and then what the character says back, but there is actually that extra description sort of filling in the spaces between the sentences where you're reading about the characters who or how the characters, react to your statements, some of their facial expressions, or like their little quirks and tics that they have. So that, and then that kind of persists into, that follows into Ultima 7 Part 2, Serpentile, same engine. Different writer, though. A lot of what made Ultima 7 kind of unique in that respect was Raymond Benson's work. He was a professional novelist. He really kind of set the tone for that. They kind of emulated that with Serpentile. And then there's hints of it again in things like Ultima 8, but, definitely a step back in terms of overall quality of it. And then with Ultima 9, of course, going to fully voiced dialogue and 3D characters that are able to actually at least somewhat convey action themselves, obviously that stepped back again. Now, if a character is going to react to something the avatar says, you're going to see the model do a double take or do some sort of arm gesture or things like that. And this was early 3D RPG, relatively speaking, came out, before Neverwinter Nights, before Dungeon Siege. So it's not particularly crazy advanced, certainly in terms of facial expressions. There's a little bit of variance there, but all the game's really doing is animating a texture, that's being applied over a handful of polygons. We're not dealing with, a Mass Effect cutscene here where you can see a lot of the emotional variation in the character's face. But that was kind of a rambling way of saying that, we do see a bit of that in the Ultima series with Ultima 7, most notably. Linguistic is right in that, you do really only see it to its maximum effect in things like the Infinity Engine games, which are very, very heavy on not just written dialogue, but written narration as well.
Yeah, I was thinking along the lines of Ultima 7 myself. That's one of the ones that I've actually finished before, and I remember that as part of the reason why I enjoyed it as much as I did. The fact that even though the character models themselves are fairly static, you still get a bit of that nuance. The other thing that stood out to me as I've been playing is the disposition system that they have. It's kind of how the game handles alignment, but it's not necessarily a good or evil sort of thing. As you go through the game, you start earning a reputation as a certain kind of character. There's 12 dispositions, like benevolent or diplomatic or rational or stoic, basically a representation of how you've reacted to situations through the game. And so, for example, if you come across a character and you disagree with their viewpoint on something or another, you might have an option to just flat out say, "I disagree." You might have the option to make fun of their point of view as a way of saying you don't agree. You might have a way of saying, "Well, I can see where you're coming from, but I don't necessarily agree myself." So you have different ways of saying the same thing. And to me, there's a lot of hullabaloo made about character customization in an RPG. About how much control you have over your character and how they look and how they act. And the most important thing to me in developing, quote-unquote, a character as you go through an RPG is how they react to situations, how they approach problems, how they respond to other people. And the way Pillars of Eternity has approached it is, again, a degree of subtlety that I don't really see in a lot of other games. It's like the way I've been playing through the game, I've earned a fair few reputations at this point, but my highest one is what's benevolent. I can't get away from playing the Avatar, apparently, in other games either. But other characters start referring to me as, "Well, I've heard that you're a kind person." And sometimes that's an advantage, and sometimes that's a disadvantage. Sometimes they expect you to do something for no reward. Or, on the other hand, sometimes they are more apt to trust you in that respect. So it's, you kind of see the flips, you kind of see both sides of the coin with each of the reputations. And I like that a little better than the other reputation systems and alignment systems I've seen in other games. It's a bit more nuanced, and I like seeing that.
Yeah, that does sound interesting. Like I say, I'm not nearly as far in, so I haven't really had a chance to explore that over much. It's a karma system on steroids, basically. So yeah, that is that's neat. But that's Obsidian for you too, right? And that, you know, like, these are the guys who they really, they approach RPG design just a little bit differently. And I mean that, I think that comes out of, you know, being largely comprised of, you know, people who worked at, well, Interplay, Black Isle. They have a very different, very imaginative approach to RPG design that, you know, it's still very much within the Western RPG motif, but it's a lot more, I guess, experimental is the word I'm going to use there, just because it's, you know, like they try and mess around with things that you don't necessarily see in other games. I mean, they did much the same, if I recall correctly, with something like KOTOR 2, right? The Knights of the Old Republic 1 had a pretty basic light side, dark side alignment system, whereas KOTOR 2, if I recall correctly, made it a little bit more complex in terms of, you know, how that was handled, and also told a much more, I think, overall engaging story that really put that choice much more at the forefront. So... my two cents.
Something I'd like to add to that, actually, is you know, much like with various systems that can be implemented in games, one of the consequences of doing that can be an exponential increase in the number of assets that need to be created. Of course, we typically think of assets in a game as a 3D model or a texture or a sound effect. But with this level of complexity with, you know, emotional systems and the way the player character can interact with NPCs and how that shapes the progression of the game, I think we may start to see a new type of asset, and that's, you know, how exactly will this affect the rest of the game. You know, how deep will the rabbit hole go? How many different conditions do we need to keep track of throughout the game? So it actually has a cohesive impact as you make these decisions through your progression. And I think eventually, as it has with other types of art assets, such as basic world building, people will find a way to do this procedurally. You may have heard of the developer Gavin Woolery, I think is how you pronounce his name.
The name's come up. I can't think of what he's done.
He successfully kickstarted a game called Voxel Quest, and he's heavily into the procedural generation of almost everything. And I briefly saw some of the work that he's been doing, and he actually is trying to distill a lot of the basic emotional and social interactions that people have mathematically into systems where NPCs can actually procedurally, through their own interactions, experience things such as jealousy. So it'll be interesting to see what the future holds for the types of systems being implemented here in Pillars of Eternity with respect to emotions and relationships and that sort of thing.
Now all of a sudden I'm reminded of, you know, the one anecdote that was Sherry Grainer Ray, I believe told this one regarding the development not of characters in Servant Isle, but in regards to the development of the Ophidian virtues. In that, you know, they were trying to come up with this, I mean, because it was an Ultima game, you know, they did want to have a system of virtues, but obviously this was not Britannia, so it was not supposed to be the Britannian virtues, and so they were trying to envision what the Ophidian virtues would be, and I think it was, she was saying it was like her and Bill Armantrout came up with, and I may have some of the characters wrong here, but if I recall correctly, it was her and Bill Armantrout, and they came up with this system, which ultimately made it into the game, more or less, which is really a little bit more, it's not purely Aristotelian in that it, you know, it regards virtue as a golden mean between two equal but opposite vices. But it does kind of flirt with that, right? Because, you know, you have order, chaos, and balance. And, you know, I mean, obviously, like, the balance is the what you want to aim for. And then there's an order virtue and a chaos virtue that contribute to this balance virtue. But then if you have an imbalance, then all of a sudden the virtue mutates into some form of negative, of evil, right? But they had this kind of all worked out, and they had it worked out in particular numerically, and someone, it was Warren Spector or Jeff, the name eludes me, someone came into the office and was just like, you can't express virtue mathematically, but you know, fundamentally, almost anything that goes into a game has to be expressed mathematically in some respect, right? Because at the end of the day, it all goes down to bytes and machine code. So, that's right. I do remember Voxel Quest. I reported on Voxel Quest. But I'm terrible with names too, so. But yeah, that is, I mean, he does want to be able to do that. Not with his initial release necessarily, but yeah, he does want to get maybe to a point where he can procedurally generate large bits of the story. And, I mean, at a certain level, like if you think about what Linguistic described, at a certain level, that wouldn't be, at the end of the day, you know, you're tracking progression in these different, these different personality types, essentially. Numerically, the game is tracking them numerically anyways, like there's a score within each of them that it's using most likely to determine which ones you most exemplify, and then, you know, character dialogue and scripting are just being written that check all of those values, and it's just like, okay, well, if this one's higher than this one, then do this, and if this one's higher than this one, then do this, if this is the biggest, do this. So, thinking about it in that respect, like, you can see how they could possibly start to automate this. But, you know, the flip side of that is, of course, that anyone who's worked with procedurally generated worlds will tell you that it's an immense amount of work to get a good procedural generation system in place for lots of different reasons. I mean, even something as simple as making assets join together in the right way. I can remember Paul Barnett tweeting about this all the time when they were still working on Ultima Forever, back when Mythic was still a thing, because some of the dungeons in that game were procedurally generated. And, you know, something as simple as, like, you know, this wall asset and this corner asset are supposed to be next to each other, except that they're misaligned by 90 degrees, and so you have, like, an essentially non-walkable dungeon. Congratulations, game-breaking bug. You know, stuff like that. I mean, it's an immense amount of work to do, and doing that with things like NPC dialogue and the more complicated aspects of quests would be a huge body of work, because not only would you have to, you know, have libraries of NPC responses and dialogue, but then, of course, you'd also have to have some way of ensuring that, you know, NPC picks initial statement A, character says B, C, or D, NPC can respond with E, G, or maybe L, but then accidentally responds with M, which is completely out of context. You know, like, you can see where that would be a very difficult thing to implement.
That is true, and something else to consider. First of all, with procedural generation, it's true. Most of the work is done up front, and it's quite a bit of work, a lot more than just manually, you know, scripting everything. But the payoff, of course, is that once you do have a solid system in place for the procedural generation of content, that after that, you can produce so much more efficiently than you ever could by creating it manually. But even further, and, you know, this has haunted games for a while now that actually try to use procedural generation, there's a trade-off in that after a while, no matter how good your systems are, the output starts to look bland. I think the Elder Scrolls IV actually received a lot of criticism for its procedural placement of plants and such. After a while, people, it just becomes tiresome. It can never fully substitute, you know, the human touch of actually manually creating the asset, whether it's graphical, whether it's the placement of plants, whether it's the way characters interact with each other. So it can certainly have its utility, but it's not without a downside.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, and I think if I recall correctly, what they ultimately did with, I don't know if they did this with Oblivion, but I'm pretty sure they did this with Skyrim, is that, you know, they did kind of an initial pass to let the procedural do a lot of the grunt work, and then they had their environment artists dive in and basically finesse it to, you know, make sure that it didn't just look like an algorithm spitting plants onto a terrain. So, anyways, I'm just going to actually unmute everybody here, albeit the control panel's being a little bit funny. So, does anybody have anything else to say on this topic, or have we kind of talked this one out and should move on?
I think we should move on.
Ditto.
Alrighty. So, still keeping with the Pillars of Eternity theme, there was a fairly recent update, and I noticed this too, actually. Steam, just like, hey guy, there's a massive update here that you need to download. I haven't done it with GOG yet. I don't even want to. I guess something like, you know, I've heard like a 20 gig update or something. Basically, a big chunk of the game had to be re-downloaded. Pillars of Eternity, of course, again, as mentioned earlier, was crowdfunded via Kickstarter, and as has kind of become the norm for Kickstarted games, there was a bit of backer-submitted content, small pieces of content that backers could submit that were included in the game at various points. One of the rewards for pledges of $500 and up was that the backer got to put their name and a personalized message on a memorial stone in one of the graveyards in the game. And I mean, obviously, you know, there does have to be some vetting here. You know, even the fact that you contributed half a grand to the development of the project, you know, doesn't mean, I guess, that, you know, you get to, like, have your tombstone say, lol dicks, or, you know, the other stupid things that people are liable to try and get away with in the online space. I mean, I'm a moderator for Shroud of the Avatar. I'm not as active as I used to be, but the stuff we see, like, you know, people coming in and trying to pick all of these forum names that are just like, okay, you're obviously, like, you know, that's obviously anti-Semitic. You can't have that name. That's just terrible. Or even worse, the stuff we see in-game that gets reported. You know, I mean, I don't know what it is, but there's just, you know, this incredible strain of immaturity that, you know, prompts a guy who, by all accounts, is older than me to give himself the name Dick McStuffins. Anyways. So, you know, obviously there does have to be some vetting of backer-submitted content, because there's always going to be people like that. But one backer, who, if I got the name right, Firedorn Lightbringer by handle, he penned a somewhat off-color poem for his in-game tombstone, which, as I understand it, read, "Here lies Firedorn, a hero in bed. He once was alive, but now he's dead. The last woman he bedded turned out a man, and crying in shame, off a cliff he ran." This inclusion was discovered by a particular Twitter user who called out Obsidian for allowing what she termed transmisogyny to be included in Pillars of Eternity, and after some deliberation, Obsidian elected to... they actually contacted Firedorn about the poem, and he subsequently elected to change its wording to avoid a PR nightmare. So the poem now, after this new update, evidently reads, "Here lies Firedorn, a bard poet. He was also a card, but most didn't know it. A poem he wrote in jest was misread. They asked for blood, so now he's just dead." I like it in the sense that, you know, it's kind of a flippant and somewhat cheeky response to, you know, the fact that people raised a stink about the initial writing, and that, you know, he's just like, well, fine, you don't like what I wrote? Well, here, now I'm going to kind of make fun of you with the new thing that I'm going to write. But I suppose the larger question here is that, you know, and the topic for the group is, was this change the right course of action for Obsidian to pursue? So who wants first kick at that?
I'll take a stab at it.
All right.
Whether or not it was the correct thing to do or the incorrect thing to do, I think the complaint about it, I think, was a bit... a bit uncalled for, a bit sensitive. I think it's basically political correctness run amok a bit. However, I do think the fact that they changed it and what it was changed to within the context are perfectly acceptable. You know, as they say, you have to pick your battles, and, you know, for either party to raise a real stink in response to, you know, the accusation of, you know, bigotry or misogyny or trans misogyny or what have you, I think would have been inappropriate. So I do like the way it was handled, the response to the complaint.
Yeah, I'm pretty much in agreement myself. I mean, I think the fact, as I understand it, they left it in the hands of Firedorn. Obsidian had contacted him. I think I remember seeing something along the lines of coming... I'm tongue-tied today. I'm pretty sure I remember seeing something coming from Firedorn where he said that Obsidian told me they'd leave it in, but they asked me if I wanted to change it. And I think that's the way to go about it, because ultimately this is content that they got from someone else. And if this is something that I too agree that it probably was a little over the top to complain about it in the first place. I mean, it's not overtly transmisogynistic, if it can even really be called that in the end. But the fact that there were complaints out there and they left it in the hands of the creator to change it or not. And I think that was an appropriate response. And I've heard people, you know, say that this is a terrible thing, that they even considered it, that they even had to ask him because of artistic integrity and all that. But like you said, it's a matter of choosing your battles. And ultimately, it's just a small bit of content in a flavor text in a side area that people may not even see. If it was something bigger, and Pillars of Eternity does cover some heavy material, if it was a crucial part of the story or even a crucial part of a side story, then maybe there would be something to the argument that it's a blow against artistic integrity. But ultimately, it's just a small detail that not everybody's going to really pay attention to. So I think they handled it well myself.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the flip side of that coin is the fact that it is such a small detail that, you know, not everybody in the game is even necessarily going to see, you know, unless you're running around reading every single tombstone in the game, and it's really nice for you if you have time for that. Congratulations. But, you know, it's one of the things, because it's such a small little out-of-the-way thing, it's just like raising a big stink about it is, yeah, it's kind of a, I don't know. I really don't know there. The one thought that I had, and you alluded to this, Linguistic, was the fact that, you know, Pillars doesn't shy away from other topics. I mean, child murder comes up. I gather that there are plot lines that touch on subjects like rape. Obviously, I'm not anywhere near that part of the game, if so. But, you know, it's mostly a high fantasy... Okay, yeah, there definitely are then. It's mostly a high fantasy setting, but there's a lot of dark fantasy elements that have been incorporated into it. I mean... And the guys at Obsidian, I mean, they are excellent writers. So you know that these subjects, as they're being handled, they're going to be handled very well, but also probably quite vividly in a lot of cases. So, you know, it's the fact that you have all of this other stuff in the game, but this one thing, this one little out-of-the-way thing, is the threshold for unacceptability. Anyways, I do agree that Obsidian handled it, I think, very, very well. I do still view it, though, as unfortunate that, you know, ultimately Firedorn did actually elect to change it, because he didn't want it to be a PR disaster for Obsidian. I think, you know, just the fact that it would have potentially turned into that sort of thing is something that I find kind of problematic myself. Not so much from an artistic integrity standpoint as just from a, you know, you stand by what you make, I guess. You know, just standing by your creation. But, yeah, I don't... in some respects, I don't fault them for changing it, but I think it's kind of part of this larger problem I have, where that, you know, like, we're at this weird point where, I mean, you know, we're all Ultima fans here, right? I mean,
we celebrate child killing.
That's been a thing in many, many Ultima games. Ultima 6, Ultima 7, you can have all the gay sex you want. You know, like, there was... I mean, obviously it's described in text rather than depicted on screen, but still, you know, like, the prostitutes... Okay, there were prostitutes in the game. There's another thing. But, you know, the prostitutes weren't picky, you know. You walk up to... You could, the dialogue tree did not have any logic to control responses based on the sex of your avatar. So, you know, and this was, you know, these games came out in like 1990, 92. I mean, this was at a time when, you know, there's still laws against that kind of thing, at least in, you know, the United States and possibly Canada. Obviously, there are still laws against it in many other parts of the world. But, you know, that's... We had all that, and it... there, and, you know... Nobody was really banging on Origin's door. And it was like, oh my god, this is the worst thing ever. How could you possibly change it now? None of that. Not that they necessarily would have had the ability to change it as easily. I mean... Nowadays, it's trivially easy to distribute a patch. Obviously, in 1992, this was not the case. Obviously, though, in 1992, things like Twitter didn't exist. And it's really unfortunate that all these great tools for communication, for bringing people together, for forming new communities, at least I find them to be such. I've embraced most of them quite fully. Have also become, you know, the instruments of what is essentially, you know, a mob. You know, the likes of which would probably not have seemed out of place in revolutionary France, but which now can operate at light speed.
Yeah, with respect to the person who actually complained about that, something I'd like to mention that. In the wake of Gamergate, not to open up that can of worms, but that hasn't received quite as much attention as I think it should, is that trolling can come from a attack vector. So we typically consider trolling, as you were mentioning before, in the Shroud of the Avatar forums, you know, racist or bigoted. Names or phrases or ideologies or what have you, that's usually what we think of when we hear the word troll. But it can come from the other side. For example, the complaint in this case may not have in fact been legitimate. The person who made that complaint could have done it as a troll. They may have in fact not actually believed or cared about what they were saying. And it's extremely difficult to know. You know, back before the World Wide Web was even known about or perhaps existed on the Usenet, they used to call it starting a flame war. And people would go into a Usenet news group and just say the most horrible thing they could possibly say to try to bait, you know, the typical inhabitants of that news group into becoming extremely offended. And then they would just enjoy the fireworks after that. And I think that happens still today from all sides.
True. But too, I think, you know, just the discourse itself has changed noticeably. I mean, one of the things, you know, when I was writing my annual Easter reflection, one of the things that I touched on was, you know, there's this, you know, just the idea that it is good that you exist, you know, you, that other person, regardless of whether I agree with you or disagree with you, the idea that it is good that you exist, which, you know, obviously, I mean, is something that I try to be mindful of in my Catholic faith, because part of that is, you know, you do believe that created things, all created things, are good. You know, they can be turned toward evil, they can elect to do evil, but that doesn't destroy the fundamental goodness of them. And so it's this idea that, you know, it's actually genuinely good that you, that other person on the other side of a screen that I can't see exist, is an idea that's really lacking in a lot of discourse today. It doesn't matter if it's politics, it doesn't matter if it's religious arguments, it doesn't matter if it's anything of that kind. It's, you know, increasingly it just seems to be, oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, it appears to me that the subtext of a lot of the discussion in these situations is that the opposing party should die. You know, the emotional level of these conversations is so high that it seems to be the exact opposite of what you're describing, that there's actually, you know, no appreciation for the fact that the person is indeed a person, you know, expressing their views, and that even if they're wrong, they could actually be in a state where at some point they'll in fact change their opinion. It's just an extremely angry, hateful conversation all around, almost warlike.
Exactly. I mean, there's an element of, you know, dehumanization that gets into it too, right? Because it's so much, it's a lot easier to maintain your own position. It's a lot easier to denounce the other person's position if you can reason away, or rationalize away rather, the fact that they're still a human being and you should still not be a dick to them, at least on that basis.
Yeah, it's always easier to rail against words than against an actual person that you're seeing face to face. You can actually see them react, see the shift in their facial expression, hear the change in their words. It's always easier to rail against something that has all of that context stripped away from it. It's just simpler to look at it that way.
Which kind of gets back to, you know, your comment about the great power of the writing in the Infinity Engine games, and by extension in Pillars, is that, you know, they really try to make these not just characters on a screen that, you know, maybe you care about because it's YOLO and you've been on a bunch of adventures with him, even though he actually, you know, like, we don't really get to know too much about YOLO over the course of the Ultima series, but, you know, he's kind of that omnipresent character, one of them, and so we care about him, right? But, you know, that's one of the things they try and do with their writing. They try and communicate what you otherwise wouldn't be able to see, the inflections, the facial expressions, the reactions, the emotional responses of the characters. Ideally, you know, so that, you know, you do start to care about their plight. And maybe you don't, maybe you just breeze past the flavor, the color commentary, and you know, just get right to, oh, what is he asking me to do? But, I mean, if you're playing the game in the mindset of, you know, that Infinity Engine type experience, that's going to be something that resonates with you. Well, you know, I have no idea how long we've been going. I haven't had a timer or anything. So I'm going to say we should probably jump to the third topic, just because, if nothing else, I can hear a couple of little whimpers over the baby monitor, so she may wake up soon. I don't know. It looks like Pillars of Eternity has been a monumental success for Obsidian Entertainment, so much so that expansions to its universe are being considered in the form of a tabletop RPG and a card game. And what that entails, Fergus Urquhart specifically detailed that the card game would release first, and would probably actually be farmed out to another development company. And he did mention that it wouldn't be like, you know, one of those collectible card games. They've kind of been all the rage for a while. There's even a Star Wars one now for mobile devices. I don't know if it's on Android. I know it was on iOS. one of the podcasts I listened to, Father Roderick was talking about it, and it was, it's evidently like the ultimate. Like, if you ever collected Star Wars cards as a child, it is evidently like exactly that, but in an app. But anyways, so apparently the Pillars of Eternity card game won't be like a collectible game or anything like that, but just some kind of fun thing that, you know, four people could get around and play a single session of. So we'll see what that entails. In terms of the tabletop RPG, again, the details are still vague, and it's apparently still in more of a conceptual state. But the studio does want to develop it, and actually, if I recall correctly, I mean, they wouldn't be the first mainline RPG developer that goes this route. It strikes me that there might be a Witcher tabletop RPG, or maybe that was just an idea that was floated, I can't recall. And again, here, Fergus, you know, mentioning that they're not sure yet how they're going to do it, that they've been going back and forth on, you know, do they use the game's rules, or do they adapt another rule set, or do they just come up with another rule set for the tabletop. So, any thoughts here? I mean, I take it as, you know, a really good sign that Pillars will probably be with us for a while. Not just as a supported title from Obsidian, but, you know, that hopefully they're able to branch it off. Thank you, Fridge, for kicking on right then. You know, that they're able to branch it off, release games across different media for it, and, I mean, hopefully, you know, produce sequels as well. So I take that as indicative of the health of the property.
Well, yeah, when you've got a setting as rich and extensive as the one of Pillars of Eternity is shaping up to be, at least through my experience of it, I mean, yeah, the natural thing to do is to give other people a format to tell their own stories in it through the means of a tabletop RPG. And, I mean, to me, it seems like a natural extension of that, because you have a setting and with history that's only barely touched on in the game. And so if you can find a way to make use of all of that extra bits that you've created for the game, more power to you.
And one thing I'd like to throw out there as far as board games and card games is I hope these are both going to be physical as opposed to an actual game that plays like a card game or a board game. I just truly do not grok why games exist that emulate those sorts of games, because like cards or dice or things like that, those are basically, you know, physical, you know, abstraction, you know, between a higher concept of the actual action that's going on. They symbolize, you know, actual combat that could be occurring or whatever other mechanics the game entails. And in the format of computer entertainment of video games or computer games, there's really no need to abstract that sort of action or mechanics through the use of cards or dice. It could actually be rendered. So it just sort of it confuses me when I see a computer game that actually shows what looks like paper cards on the screen, or shows actual dice, or shows an actual board game. I mean, it could be that it's simply a matter of convenience, you know, that the person doesn't have to have the physical cards. But I just find there's something inherently strange about that.
Well, I mean, yeah, there is an element of that. I guess the advantage of it is the fact that, you know, I mean, I'm busy, my buddies are busy, my wife is busy, and at least actually within my circle of friends, we don't always necessarily share overlapping interests. I mean, the body of friends that I kind of came through life with, one of the things we kind of thrived on was the fact that in a lot of ways we were wildly, wildly different. And that, you know, sort of together as a group, that worked really, really well. But, you know, I don't know if any of, you know, the guys I would normally hang out with backed Pillars of Eternity. I don't know if any of them have played it, one or two maybe. So, both from time and from circumstance, you know, I can certainly say that I don't always have time to, you know, sit down with three or four guys at a table and throw out the deck of cards and quickly go over the rules and then hash out a game for a couple of hours. But, on the other hand, my phone's almost never not close to me, right? So the ability to dip into an app and play even asynchronously with other people, I mean, there's an appeal there because, you know, I still want that experience, but I don't necessarily have real-life opportunities for it as much as I would have virtual opportunities for it. So I think, you know, part of it comes down to that, is the fact that you don't always, I mean, you don't need to be physically present with other players, which can often make it easier to put together a group for a game. Convenience is another factor. I mean, it's a lot easier to carry a phone around than it is to carry multiple decks of cards around. Now, at the same time, though, you do lose something in that experience. There's something to be said for sitting around a table with people and your beers and your snacks and all the rest, and just having a good old time all in the same room. I mean, obviously, that camaraderie is really second to none. So, you know, it is one of those terrible trade-offs that technology sometimes enables, where you have a lot of advantages on both sides, but some fairly noticeable disadvantages as well. Myself, I do hope, actually, that they do go with physical games for both. But at least in terms of the card game, I wouldn't necessarily be surprised to see it maybe also manifest as an app.
I see the convenience of that. I suppose from the perspective of a designer or a programmer, it just bothers me that it seems to be an abstraction of an abstraction. It's like we have cards because we don't have the technology to actually show you real combat, so these cards symbolically represent combat and what we think are logical rules that it may entail. Oh, but you also can't physically be around people to hold the cards, so we're going to abstract the cards by rendering them in 3D on your screen instead of giving you physical cards. So you're stacking one on top of the other. I suppose that just, I don't know, it seems a bit, you know, if you do that enough times, then
and
it starts to lose all sense of reality.
A little bit, yeah, but at the same time, I mean, you know, games like that, they make money hand over fist. They really do. So, obviously, at least if nothing else, it's an experience that people are going looking for or are happy to find, right? It's not like
they're not forcing anyone. That's what the masses want.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? I mean, it would be one thing if, you know, a couple of these games had been made and they completely flopped, and then, you know, the industry would have moved on to whatever new abstraction they could think up. But, you know, here we have games like Hearthstone, games like this, you know, this Star Wars trading card game and a bunch of others that have really, I mean, far from dying, they've proliferated. It's kind of the same with Match 3 games. I mean, heck, even I've played Bejeweled. I find it kind of simplistic. My wife is more or less totally addicted to Frozen Freefall, you know, which is a slightly more convoluted Match 3 game that throws in a few additional mechanics and some randomizations and whatever else. You know, why have these things proliferated? And yet they have. But, I mean, too, you know, we're busy. We're very busy. And the idea that you can pop into a game casually when you have 5 minutes to spare, like, there's... I can see the appeal. I like the longer games, I do. But, you know, at the end of the day, whether Pillars of Eternity's story takes me 50 hours to digest or 100 hours to digest. I mean, Reckoning, again, you know, I always touch on this as an example because I love it so much, but it's relevant here because, you know, like, here's a game I sunk, what was my final count? I mean, it was over 100 hours into the game. And it took, what, like 18 months to get that much time in? So it's one of those things where, you know, whereas, I mean, I've logged as many hours in something like Galaxy on Fire 2, playing it 5 or 10 minutes at a time on my phone. So, you know, because I have 5 or 10 minutes a lot more often than I have 2 or 3 hours.
Just wait until you start actually developing games. Then you'll have no time to play them.
Gosh, don't get me started. I mean, I'm still trying to figure out how to keep this podcast going and work on Ultima Return. Don't even get started.
That's the irony of game development, is game developers don't, in fact, play games.
Not really. I mean, apart from, like, you know, occasionally, I mean, but, you know, I'm, but then again, too, I mean, at some point, it's like taking your work home with you, you know? It's like, am I playing this, or am I researching? So, all right. Well, gosh, I don't even know when we started this, but I can see that it's almost 10 my time, and there are still a few things I need to do. So, unless anyone else has any other commentary they want to throw out there, why don't we step our way into the closeout? So, actually, here's a good question. Does anybody have any shout-outs that they want to offer? Going once, going twice.
What exactly is a shout-out?
Just a quick little cheers or kudos, you know.
We should have closing toasts. That's what we should have, like the dragons mean.
That would almost have worked better, and I really wish I hadn't left my drink upstairs. Because I'm really thirsty, actually. But,
You can hold up a playing card and pretend it symbolizes drinking.
Yeah, like an episode ago.
Abstractions.
Well, that's not bad. Hang on, wait, I've got, you don't know that this, what is in this cup or not. Neither do I, for that matter.
It's mostly nitrogen.
So, anyways, like, anyways, okay, yeah, so, and I didn't actually write any down ahead of this, so I'm kind of thinking on the fly here. You know what? I'm actually going to say just to you two, because I think this is a really good idea we've got going here. I hope we're able to sustain it. And it's really cool to have people on board to kick this out with. So, Linguistic, Julian, you're awesome.
All right.
So, and this is kind of more for, you know, those listening in. Always remember, if you'd like to recommend anyone for a shout-out, send an email to ultimacodex@gmail.com, which you can also use to suggest podcast topics, offer commentary or criticism about podcast episodes, and or volunteer your time, you know, to join us, either an occasional or a regular contributor to podcast sessions. As well, if you haven't already, there are Ultimate Dragons groups on both Facebook and Google+. Definitely recommend joining one or both of those. The Facebook group is easily the larger and more lively, but that just means that we need to grow the Google+ one a little bit more and get people posting content there on a little bit more regular basis. Finally, I mean, the Ultima Codex and its predecessor have been my undertaking for over a decade now, and they don't exactly come cheap. I mean, there was a time when it was fairly cheap to run, you know, Ultima Era, but that time passed, and, you know, especially now with things like, you know, the Shroud of the Avatar IRC channel, especially now with, you know, the fact that it went from being just a simple fan project site that saw news posted to it only occasionally to a fairly significant news hub that is frequented as much by developers as fans. It stopped being something that I could run on $8 a month hosting. So there is the Ultima Codex Patreon, patreon.com/UltimaCodex. $10 pledges do get you access to spam humbug episodes. I post them there one day before they go live on the site. But more important than that, you'll be helping maintain and, with sufficient funding, expand the server infrastructure of the Codex to better deliver all the things you come looking for there at. And also to continue supporting things like the Shroud of the Avatar IRC channel, and we've pitched the idea to a couple of other groups of former Origin developers as well, in case they need it. So, yes, by all means. Alrighty. So on that basis, I'll say goodnight from where I am. Boolean has suddenly disappeared off screen, but Linguistic, if you want to say goodnight, here's a good time for that.
Yeah, goodnight all. Thanks for having me in on this.
Cool. And Boolean, you want to say a quick fare thee well?
Fare thee well. Journey on.
Well, that works nicely. All right. So this has been Spam Humbug. Been a great time. Hope you enjoyed. And tune in next week and be virtuous.